This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 305, was recorded on January 6, 2022. I'm Eric Townsend. Happy New Year. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Masterworks, the billion-dollar alternative investment platform that lets you invest in art by legends like Warhol and Picasso for a fraction of the cost. Grant Williams returns as the first feature interview guest of the new year. We'll step way back and talk about the big picture, starting with the predictions we both made after the great financial crisis and how history took a different path, along with what lays ahead and what we're going to discover as we find out whether inflation is really set to be transitory or secular. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Patrick's chart deck is titled Talking Charts.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, let's just jump straight into this. The S&P 500 was looking very bullish, new fresh highs, holding up along all the gains. And then the FOMC comes out, and we have a pretty decisive drop yesterday on the downside. Do you think this is a meaningful trend reversal or a buy on dip?
Well, for now, it seems like they're buying the dip. The thing that I find interesting, Patrick, is what really brought this about, so far as I can tell, is just changes in expectations that maybe what the Fed is signaling is a slightly more aggressive timeline for this hiking or tapering cycle, whatever they're going to call it. So they're going to remove stimulus maybe a little bit more quickly than they had threatened previously, and that's freaking everybody out. What this all says to me is it's a massive statement of overcomplacency. Everybody's assuming, whatever, you know, the Fed's eventually going to back the market up no matter what, because that's what they always do. Now we've gotten to the point where the complacency is so strong that even when the Fed says, we're going to taper, we're going to remove accommodation, we're going to remove stimulus, everybody says, we know better. It's they don't really mean it. Well, the thing is, I think the Fed's backed themselves into a corner that they've got to at least pretend to mean it for a little while. So I think the market's got some turbulence ahead before this can be over, Patrick. Now, the other side of that is I am going to make the call that I think it very likely that the pandemic is probably about to end and that the Omicron variant will be remembered as the salvation, as the thing that crowded out the more dangerous strains and basically replaced the dangerous kind of COVID with something which unfortunately will become endemic and probably be with us forever. Something I really found interesting in Dr. John Campbell's latest videos. Dr. John Campbell is one of the people who's gotten this story right from the very beginning, as did Dr. Chris Martinson, who we had on January 30th of 2020, telling us that a global pandemic was coming. The point that Dr. Campbell makes is, look, a lot of places like New Zealand have had these lockdowns, which have prevented everybody from getting Omicron. Campbell's point is, everybody on the planet is going to get Omicron. This thing is so transmissive that eventually it's going to run ravage through the whole planet. That means that governments like New Zealand and to some extent China that have successfully kept Omicron out for now are going to have to decide not whether, because that's not an option, but when they allow Omicron to run its course through their population. And of course, there are arguments for trying to flatten that curve and avoid overwhelming the medical system. But the point that Campbell is making is we need to accept that this thing is going to run the whole world over. Basically, everybody is going to get it. It's going to result in herd immunity, which ends the pandemic. So it's going to be probably remembered as a good thing in the end. But how does this all play out and what is it going to mean to the economy as we have to allow Omicron to run ravage across the entire globe and infect almost everybody and get people sick for a few days? What does that do to the economy? How long does it take to recover? I think those are going to be the most important questions to ask. And as we pose those questions, Patrick, I don't even know how to respond, because normally I would say if a global pandemic is ending, that's good news. It ought to be good for the economy. Well, wait a minute. What's supported the stock market rally has been mostly the presence of accommodation that was provided by the Federal Reserve because of the pandemic. So if the pandemic is really ending, does that mean that it's bad news for the stock market because it's good news for humanity? I'm not sure. We'll see what happens.
All right. Well, let's move on to that U.S. dollar because we remain in that trade range, strengthening a little bit. Certainly moves in things like the U.S. dollar against the Japanese yen that really started earlier this week. But really, we're still in this tight range. What do you think is in store for the dollar here?
I have no idea what's in store, but as you say, we're consolidating in a tight range, and we've got to wait for a print outside of that range before we can conclude that there's a technical signal. I really don't know in terms of fundamentals which way to call this market just because there's so many moving pieces and so many questions of policy. So I think we're waiting for this indecision because the market is undecided about where we stand. This FOMC statement seems to have triggered a big reaction. Is that going to all blow over and be forgotten about by next week, or is the beginning of a new trend? I guess we'll find out.
All right. Well, let's jump to crude oil because the one thing that hasn't been shaken during this little reaction on the FOMC was crude. And it just continues to truck along here. And we're basically printed temporarily up, above $80 here. What do you think is in store? We're going for a full double top retest and a new high?
I think we are going to new highs here, but the thing to realize is what's happened just in the last few days is there's been a bit of an artificial bump in the price and also in the time spreads as a result of the extreme cold temperatures forcing a shut-in of the Keystone Pipeline. They had to shut it down for more than a day, I guess, and it's back online now, but there are also some parts of the Bakken that are apparently getting shut in due to extreme cold. So it's going to, at least in the temporary time frame, there's going to be some price support coming from extreme cold temperatures. But independent of that, I do think we're headed to much higher prices. The thing was, we were expecting a bigger drawdown than we got this week. A lot of people were expecting at least 3 million barrels. We only saw 2.1 million barrels drawn down nationally. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 2.6 million barrels. Very much needed oil going into Cushing, Oklahoma. Now, some analysts think that was the end, as evidenced by time spreads blowing up in the last couple of days. That's happening in reaction to the shut-in of the pipeline, which was only temporary, and some other supply disruptions going into Cushing. I'll be watching those time spreads to see if that reverses out. But really big product builds. That's a 10.1 million barrel build on gasoline and a 4.4 million barrel build on distillates. Those are offsetting the drawdown of crude oil dramatically. Now, the thing is, it's kind of normal for the last week of the calendar year, which is what we're reporting now, is last week's numbers, for those product builds to be artificially high. And it has to do with people basically avoiding taxes by hanging on to inventory before it gets sold. I don't know exactly what the particulars are, but people tell me that this is normal to have kind of a high print as the last print of the year. It'd be very interesting to see how the trend continues to evolve, and particularly whether or not we see more oil coming back out of Cushing, Oklahoma, which would put more pressure to the upside on those time spreads that have blown up in the last couple of days.
All right. Well, let's move on to gold, because the interesting part was that gold was looking pretty good right up into the FOMC. We were trading right up toward that 1830. And just after the news came out, gold lost almost all of its momentum. And here we are trading under 1800 again. What do you think is in store here?
Well, Patrick, let's go back to last week's commentary. What I said is, hey, this chart is finally looking really good. But what's happened the last few times it was really looking pretty good is we got surprised by a fake breakout to the upside and a reversal to the downside. And I said, watch out for the same thing. Even before FOMC, we saw the beginnings of that the very next day with a great big red candle last Friday, started to recover from that into FOMC, and then another great big down. So at this point, you know, we had been breaking out finally above all those moving averages from the 100-day to the 5-day, 13-day, 21-day. They're all clustered together between around 1798 and 1811. We were above all of those moving averages, which is really good. Looks like a bull trend. Now we're below all of them, and we're closing below them today. So that looks like the beginnings potentially of a bear trend. But just as I said last week, that every time it looks good, it seems to turn bad. Sometimes when it's looked bad, it surprised us and turned good. So we need to see this turn around pretty quickly. quickly. If we stay below all those moving averages for several days, it really is an ominous sign that there could be substantially lower numbers to come. But for now, Patrick, let's leave room to consider the possibility this is just a knee-jerk lower in reaction to the hawkish FOMC, and maybe it's all going to reverse to the upside. I sure hope so.
All right. Well, let's move to the 10-year Treasury yield. I want to talk about these charts as well in the post game, but finally, yields are moving, and we were in that tight range between 140 to 150, and now suddenly rates are moving and potentially even breaking out to a new year high. What's your take here? Is this the beginning of a substantial repricing of bonds?
Well, I've lost track of how many months it's been, Patrick, that I've been saying, look, I got nothing to say new about the bond market until we get a print above 1.70 on the 10-year. That's when I'm, you know, going to pull my seat up, make a fresh batch of popcorn and watch closely and see what happens next. That's where I am. I don't really have an opinion here other than, okay, we're now seeing some action. Are we going to see that the market wants to confirm secular inflation with a structural move higher in rates? Or is there an argument that we're not even going to see that structural move higher in rates? If we're going to have a deflationary move that's going to take us much lower in yields, well, here's your chance to buy those bonds at a substantially higher yield if you think that we're going higher in price and lower in yield. But maybe we're going the other way. So I'm at the point of pulling my seat closer and making up a fresh batch of popcorn. I don't know what's going to happen next, but it's time to pay close attention.
All right. Well, this week's feature interview guest is Grant Williams. Eric, why did we invite Grant back on the show?
Well, Patrick, Grant is one of the best big picture, high level thinkers that we know. And for the first show of the new year, I wanted to get him back just to really take a big step back from the usual week to week that we do and say, where are we in the big story of the world? I'm going to be doing another interview with Grant about the future of financial markets on the Smarter Markets podcast in a few weeks. So we'll get you a link when Grant and I do that talk as well. But I really enjoyed this one. I think you're going to enjoy it as well.
Eric's interview with Grant is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was brought to you by Abex, a fintech company traded under ticker symbol ABXXF on the OTCQX in the United States and ABXX on the Equitas Neo in Canada. Abex was founded on the principle of creating market-based solutions to solve the world's most challenging problems. Two of these issues in particular, the energy transition and climate change, are creating once-in-a-generation opportunities for investors. Abex is leveraging proprietary Web 3.0 technologies to digitize and accelerate the velocity and security of commodity trading markets, beginning with liquefied natural gas and carbon. Investors seeking exposure to the fintech applications powering this new era of the ESG economy can visit www.abex.tech or www.abex.exchange, or check out ABXX on the Equitas Neo or ABXXF on the OTCQX exchanges.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Things That Make You Go, founder and editor Grant Williams. Grant, it's great to have you back. First interview of the new year. I want to send the Wayback Machine all the way back 13 years ago this week. It was 2008 coming into 2009. We hadn't gotten to the final bottom in the stock market yet. You and I and a lot of other people really thought that financial crisis was about too much debt, and we thought that the proposed remedy, which seemed to be creating more debt, was not going to be sustainable. And we made a lot of arguments back then saying, look, you can't just have the central bank propping up asset markets indefinitely. That's not sustainable. At least that's what I said. I don't want to put words in your mouth. I know I said it wasn't sustainable. Gosh, it's been a dozen years, Grant, and they're sustaining it so far. At least that's the way I see it. How should we think about the fact that, although I still don't think it's sustainable long term, and I think that they're driving us into what could be a really big inflation trap, definitely they could sustain things longer than I thought back 10 or 12 years ago. And it seems like in the eyes of a lot of people, all of us skeptics got it wrong. And central bankers have proven that there really is a perpetual motion machine of finance here in the form of central bank largesse. How does this go from here? What do you think is on the horizon?
Well, first of all, Happy New Year to you, mate, and to everybody listening.
What a way to say Happy New Year. Did I just give you a great introduction?
Yeah, no, exactly.
Or what?
Hey, listen, it's a great question. I mean, look, you're right. I think I would bracket myself with you as saying that if you'd put a gun to my head 12 years ago and said, painted me a picture of life at the end of 2021 and asked me whether that was realistic, I would have said, hell no. But, you know, I think the piece of the puzzle that perhaps a lot of people missed was that the market just wouldn't care about anything but liquidity. They wouldn't care about valuations. They would come to mean nothing to people, and that they would be happy to pay crazy multiples for things with no profits or no chance of making a profits for the foreseeable future. And I think that's the part that it was really hard to foresee ahead of times, because, you know, that stuff has always mattered. And let's face it, regardless of any kind of suspension of that belief for the time being, we all know that it does matter. If you are buying the shares in a company, you are buying those future cash flows. And if they're negative at some point, that is not going to work out. Now, while the vast majority of market participants have the belief that either the Fed has their back or there's going to be ample liquidity, low rates forever, and a bunch of people forced into putting money into the market as a place to get any kind of return that they can't get in the bond market, then, you know, look, it can be sustained, and it has been sustained. The problem with that, as you've pointed out and your numerous guests on your show have pointed out, is that you're just creating a bigger and bigger problem that will have to be faced on the day when all of this suddenly matters again. And, you know, it could be rising rates that make it matter, which is why the return of inflation is such a big problem. It could be some kind of collective awakening that makes people realize that they've paid the wrong price for all kinds of different things. Who knows? It could be something that none of us have thought of. And generally, that's the way these things tend to work out. But look, I agree. It's amazing where we've gotten to. And if you look at how we closed 2021, you know, there's this idea that markets are closing on or around the highs and have gone to make new highs. But if you look at some of the data, which is pretty extraordinary, you take away the top performing stocks from these markets. You know, the Nasdaq, for example. The average distance from the 52-week high of all stocks in the Nasdaq is 40%. 40% below the 52-week high, while the index is just 3.5% below the 52-week high. You know, you go right through all of these. You go to the S&P. You know, the average stock is almost 12% below its 52-week high. The market closed at or within 0.5% of its high. You know, these are strange divergences that have been covered up by a small group of stocks which have price-insensitive buyers, because they've been shoved into just about every ETF you can possibly think of. And, you know, at some point, you sound like a broken record saying this, because we don't know when that point will be, but financial sanity and financial gravity will return at some point. It just will be that way. You cannot suspend your disbelief forever. So, you know, does it happen this year? I would say we have as much chance as we do any other January the 1st trying to predict that. But this is why it's so important to understand what the return of inflation does and why it's such a dangerous phenomenon at the best of times. Given the setup right now, the return of inflation creates a whole different set of problems because of this inability by central banks to raise rates by any meaningful degree to combat it. So I think this year there's going to be a moment when the central banks are going to stare down the barrel of a gun and have to decide what to do. And, you know, we can talk about what their options are. They're getting fewer by the week. And at some point, I suspect there is going to have to be some extraordinary monetary policy of the non-QE kind, rather of the capital control, credit control kind, which look, nobody wants.
You know, I think that last point that you just made, Grant, was the most important thing really in all of finance, which is really, if you take inflation out of the equation, if you don't worry about inflation, if you somehow think that there's just never going to be any meaningful inflation, and those three Ds that David Rosenberg talked about are going to keep us out of the inflation camp, then it seems to me like it's time to concede that maybe Ben Bernanke really did invent the financial perpetual motion machine, because clearly nothing's going wrong in terms of this being unsustainable, as so many of us said it would be. Unless there's something that's going to come back and bite us. And it seems to me that that something is, as long as there's a disinflationary backdrop, the central bank can solve almost any problem by printing money in order to spend it to make the problem go away, at least in the short term. The question is, does doing that lead to secular inflation that eventually runs away and they can't fight it? And that would be the final moment of payback, where you realize, okay, there really is no free lunch, and that has to be how this ultimately gets reconciled. Seems to me like if there's never any inflation, then there really is never a problem, and central banks can get away with doing more of what they're doing. Is that right? And what do we do to start thinking about what I think is going to be a bigger than 1970-sized inflation that I think we're just seeing the beginnings of?
Well, it's a great question. And, you know, if we think about this logically, the big debate over 2020, and I've had it with just about everybody I've spoken to, is, you know, is it inflation or deflation? And there are mutual friends of ours, Eric, very bright guys, very credible guys on both sides of that argument, who each make a fantastic case for why it's one or the other. Now, the answer, unfortunately, is always both, right? It's never one or the other. It's periods of one and periods of the other. And we are going to get deflation and inflation. The question is trying to get the sequencing right. And we've had this, let's call it disinflationary period for a while. It's hard to call it deflation given what we're seeing with prices of just about everything. But now that's starting to show up in headline numbers. And the reason that's problematic is it changes the mindset of consumers. And this is where we start to get into a problem, where even if the Lacey Hunts and the Dave Rosenbergs of the world who call for continued deflation are correct in the long term, if they're wrong in the short term, that's all it really takes. You know, we live in a deflationary, disinflationary world. You know, mankind's history of one is one of progress, technological advancement that does generally bring the cost of things down. It makes man have to work less. That's what we've done as a species since we crawled out of the primordial ooze. We've tried to make things easier for ourselves, and we'll continue to do that. But if Rosie and Lacey are wrong in the short term, and we get a meaningful inflationary pulse, which it looks like we're seeing, that's all it really takes to upset the apple cart. And that's how fragile this thing is. You know, we could stand, as the Fed would, begging to get slightly above 2% inflation for a short period of time to try and even out things and get back to their average 2% over time, which they assured us was what was going to happen. But if you get, you know, three times your target rate for a year or maybe 2 years, that's when you start to get expectations changing. And expectations are everything in the inflation game. You know, if people expect prices to continue to rise at 6%, well, you know what? They are going to bring purchases forward, and they're going to add fuel to that fire. You throw in supply chain issues and shortages everywhere, and it just incentivizes people all over again to spend money now, not just spend money in the now rather than the future, but also pay higher prices for it. Because as another mutual friend of ours, Pippa Malmgren, said to me recently, quite rightly, people have a very near-term memory of being unable to buy certain goods at any price thanks to the pandemic in early 2020. You know, you couldn't buy cleaning products. You couldn't buy toilet paper. You couldn't buy a bunch of essentials that we've taken for granted, no matter what you were willing to pay for them. So that kind of mindset gives producers the ability to pass on increasing input costs to consumers. And that's what they're trying to do. And if you look at across some of the producer, some of the input costs indices right across the US, across the UK, across Europe, you know, some of them are climbing by almost 30% year on year. And so, okay, companies have done well during the pandemic. Their profit margin has been great, and maybe they can carry that for a little while in the hope that it is transitory. But they can't carry those kind of margin squeezes forever. They're going to have to try and pass whatever of that on they can. And they will be able to pass more of it on this year than they would last year, simply because of that mindset. Now you throw in to the mixing bowl wage increases, which are happening everywhere now. Many of them driven by companies wanting to look like good corporate citizens, other driven by potential industrial action. But either way you cut it, there are that we've seen wage inflation for the first time in almost 40 years now. And that, once it takes hold, is the most entrenched inflation of all, because you're going to struggle to take away anything. If you give people a 5, 10% wage hike, good luck taking that back next year. You know, you can raise prices of your goods and lower them again. That's not too difficult to do, but try taking away the salary that someone's the salary increase that someone's fought long and hard for. You're not going to be able to do that without major problems. So I think we're in the eye of this perfect storm here, Eric, where all the conditions are in place for meaningful inflation to take hold and certainly maintain that hold for enough of the foreseeable future to cause the kind of problems that we spoke about at the top of the show. How do they combat them? Can they raise interest rates? If so, how far can they raise them before the markets break? And so while I think in the long term, Dave Rosenberg and Lacey are probably right, I think in the short term, they can be very, very wrong. And if they're wrong, it means the Fed are wrong. And if the Fed are wrong, it means interest rates are wrong. And if interest rates are wrong, then, you know, everything is priced wrong. And that's something that we will have to try and figure out as and when that kind of rolling disaster starts going down the hill.
Now, I want to run a few thoughts past you because, ironically, I find myself inclined to argue kind of the opposite case of the one I most, you know, long-term believe in. I still think that there is no free lunch, and I don't believe that there's a perpetual motion machine, and I think we are going to pay for all this largesse someday. But the thing is, Grant, if I look at what's going on right now, politically, there's a lot of support for more transfer payments, for universal basic income, for, you know, more handouts, basically, for more stimulus for the economy. There's lots of political support for that. The kinds of things that you and I think could go wrong in terms of a runaway inflation that gets out of hand and can't be controlled, well, I think that's a very real risk, but it's not here and now. It's not in this moment. If anything, the Fed has been very frustrated that they've been trying to create more inflation and they've been unable to do so. So they're just, you know, finally celebrating that they're getting a little bit of inflation finally. We're a long ways from the point where that inflation runs away, which is where I think you really, really, really have a big problem. Till then, it seems to me like really the dominoes are kind of lined up for the markets to continue to grind higher on more stimulus and the Fed continuing to have the markets back. I suppose the counter argument is the announcement of the taper. But frankly, I don't take the whole taper too seriously. I think it only lasts until they need to bail the market out for some reason. And then I think their policy story is going to change. And I think everybody already knows that and it's priced in.
Well, you know, it's interesting idea to kick around, Eric. And I think that's why I bring up the kind of numbers beneath the hood of where these markets are actually trading in terms of markets being at all-time highs, because that's the narrative, right? Markets are at or near all-time highs, a few percentage points off their all-time highs. And it just isn't the case, you know.
Because everybody knows a global pandemic is what really gooses the economy.
Yeah, I know, right? But I don't think anybody really has a problem understanding or believing that it is this liquidity that is the most important ingredient. Low rates and ultimately the liquidity supplied by central banks is the most important ingredient if we are to keep markets buoyant. But that hasn't changed, right? What we've seen with markets and the majority of stocks being, you know, between, I don't know, 12 and 40% on average below their 52-week highs is that there is distribution here and people who don't believe that this is going to be enough. There are people exiting the stock market or shifting, rotating out of equities into who knows what. It's always very difficult to get a real picture of what's happening, but this is consistent. You know, the NASDAQ Composite, the NASDAQ 100, the S&P, mid-caps, small-caps, all of those markets, the average stock is trading double digits below the 52-week high when the index is at or on its all-time highs. And that just tells you that people, while I think everybody believes that the Fed will always do what they need to do to keep markets higher, I mean, that belief has been hard won by the Fed over you know, best part of two decades now. People are voting by moving money out of these markets, which tells you that while they believe that that's what the Fed are going to do, it says to me they're not sure that what they're going to do is going to be enough this time around because of this change in dynamic with the return of inflation. So your point is well taken, and I think you're absolutely correct. But, and I hate to say this time is different, but clearly there is a factor here that we haven't had to face in the last 20 years of this policy, and that is a meaningful inflationary pulse. And it really does change everything if that is remotely sticky. And even if, let's say, the comps get better this year and inflation year on year is only 3% or 4%, you know, that's just the difference year over year. It's still going up. Prices are still going up. People are still going to be demanding more wages. And, you know, there are so many pressure points here, whether it be for central banks or whether it be for governments, in terms of people not wanting to go back to work, people preferring to stay home, people expecting elevated transfer payments, whatever it may be. There are pressure points all over this now. And so to try and steer and navigate your way through this perfectly without accidentally causing a problem somewhere, I think is going to be borderline impossible. I would never say it's impossible. You never know what a committed set of central bankers and a public willing and, in fact, determined to believe them and have them protect them can do. But I would think this is going to be the hardest year to navigate that we've seen in the last 15.
Grant, I want to move on now and talk about what I think is going to be a big trend in the economy in the next year, which is I think that this pandemic is finally ending. And specifically, I think that the Omicron strain is most likely going to be remembered as a blessing, not as a problem. And I think the Omicron strain is going to essentially crowd out, to borrow a finance term, the previous strains. It's the most transmissive. It's going to be the one that becomes what they told us the first one was going to be, which is just a bad cold. It's probably going to become endemic as one of the biggest causes of common colds in the future. But I think it's finally going to end this pandemic. And my prediction is everybody's behavior is going to change. I know that a lot of other people have predicted this, but I just look at myself and I say, I feel very differently about the world than I did 2 years ago. I feel like assuming that tomorrow can be taken for granted is a foolish assumption. And I want to go out and live my life and travel more and make a list of all the things I want to do before my life is over and get them done without assuming that tomorrow is going to be another day that I have the same ability to travel the world as I used to. I think a lot of people are going to have that attitude and to various different degrees. They can afford to travel or they can't afford to travel, but there's going to be a lot of stimulus money and a lot of credit that's being made available. And I think a lot of people are going to want to spend and travel and do things as we reopen the economy in the next year. Do you agree? And what does it mean? Because I mean, I can't normally when people do spending and traveling and, you know, that's all really good. It's supposed to drive markets up. But considering the pandemic drove markets up, should we be considered that, you know, as bad was the new good, as good the new bad?
Well, look, I preface this with the fact that I'm no virologist. So whenever I get involved in talking about COVID, I want to state that I can make observations on what I see and what I read. And, you know, it's been interesting to me from day one, the extremes of information that scientists are coming up with. You know, it's just, to me, a massive indicator of how polarized society is in general these days. But look, I can tell you anecdotally, I'm in the UK at the moment, and you know, my daughter and her partner have both had Omicron. They both felt like they had a nasty cold for a couple of days, and they're both feeling much better now. I know three or four other people that have had the Omicron variant, same. You know, they were vaccinated, but it really didn't hamper them in any way, shape, or form, apart from being forced to isolate due to regulations. They just felt like they had a head cold, and that was it. So I'm inclined to agree with you, certainly on what I've seen so far, that Omicron could potentially be a very good thing and could lead to exactly the outcome you suggest, where it becomes something that we don't have to be afraid of for the most part. It helps build up antibodies and immunity, and people are sick for a couple of days and then go on. And I think that will liberate an awful lot of people into getting back out into the world. Now, does it change the way you suggest? I don't know. It's a very plausible suggestion that you outlined there, Eric. I can totally see how a lot of people will do that. One thing's for certain, if you are right, and that is the way things go, it is certainly not going to dampen inflationary pressure. It's going to add to that significantly, I would imagine. So that's one thing to be wary of. Another thing, though, on the other side of that is there are a lot of people who've been changed in the other direction. There are a lot of people who, for the last couple of years, have realized they don't want to be working in an expensive city. They'd rather work from home. They'd rather live a quiet life, and they'd rather live, you know, peacefully away from a city and kind of turn inwards rather than turn outwards and start traveling the world. So I think we're going to see both ends of that particular spectrum. And it really is impossible at this point to try and figure out what that means, because one outcome is you know, deflationary for real estate prices in major cities and inflationary for the suburbs. We've already seen a good deal of that. The other is going to increase discretionary spending dramatically, and that will feed through the economy very quickly. You know, I think it's important for everybody to sit here at the beginning of this year and realize that we really don't know the answer to any of these questions. There are so many plausible possibilities on the table right now, all of which, given the fragility of the system in general, could pose outsized problems to the whole financial system. So people need to think that through. And, you know, you can pick up a decent broadsheet newspaper in just about any Western democracy now and read on the same day coverage and opinion in that same paper that says, you know, we should be locked down and Omicron is a killer. And people saying, this is great, let's open up and let's all get Omicron. So we just don't know. And even the scientists, there's no broad consensus among them. You can find scientists at either end of the kind of scale of fear and safety. And so it's a very dangerous time for us as kind of investors who are perhaps not as initiated in these subjects as we ought to be, to make sweeping judgments with an enormous amount of certainty about what is going to happen. Things are going to be very, very fluid this year, more so than I think we've seen. We've generally had this rising tide for a decade now. I don't think you're going to have that this year. I think you might see relief rallies. I think you might see, you know, markets surge on good news. But again, I come back to this distribution we're seeing underneath the headline figures in equity markets, and there are smart money investors who have been selling out for months now, looking at valuations, looking at the elevated levels, rotating into countries which haven't done anywhere near as well as the United States. And that's just about every stock market in the world. So I just don't think it's cut and dry. And even if you get the direction right, even if you figure out, okay, that's the way people are going to live their lives, even if you're 100% right and the majority of people do that, what that means for asset prices is very difficult to determine. It's not just a simple if X, then Y equation we have here. So I think this year is going to be extremely tricky to navigate, which is going to be problematic for people who have all their money invested in passive. And as we know, passive has sucked in an inordinate amount of savings over the last 5 or 10 years because of the low costs, because of the simplicity, because of the ease of it. And that, again, has been perfectly adequate in markets that have generally trended in one direction. But I don't think we're going to see that this year. I don't think we're going to see a market that, you know, ends this year higher with a couple of small drawdowns in between now and December 31st. I think you're going to start to see some real serious swings in both directions this year as the market tries to figure out if this is a top. And I think you have to be paying really close attention.
Well, Grant, let's talk a little bit more then about asset allocation and what you do in a situation like this, because I think we both agree that markets are at really extreme high valuations. There are some good reasons to suspect that policy will continue to drive things even higher, but someday it seems like there's got to be some reckoning here. What do you buy in this environment? Value guys say you buy what's cheap. Well, I don't know what's cheap in this market, and I don't think anything's cheap. What do you do in a market situation like this?
Yeah, look, it's a tricky one, right? You're absolutely right. I mean, if you look on a relative basis, and bearing in mind the money, unless people go to cash, which is going to mean all kinds of assets just fall, the people are going to be looking to rotate because they want to stay invested because they get nothing for their cash. In fact, they're losing money if inflation continues the way it is. So you have to look at the commodities complex, which is, you know, while it's had some spikes on a broad basis, it's definitely not had the kind of inflows that we've seen into technology. You know, I think there are parts of the biotech world, particularly in the UK, the UK biotech sector is trading actually remarkably cheaply. It's kind of an unloved and orphaned sector. You know, my great friend Steve Diggle does a lot of work in this, and there are some companies in UK biotech which are trading at vast discounts to how they are in the US because of those reasons. You know, I think rotating out of the US equity market into some of the more unloved ones, whether you go into emerging markets, which on a relative basis to the US look much cheaper. There are pockets of value across Europe in equities still. You know, if we do get this inflationary surge, then as crazy as it sounds, given the levels of leverage in the system, on an individual basis, you know, leverage that you can afford to cover out of your cash flow makes an awful lot of sense. You know, if we are going to see debasement of the currency, then it makes sense to have leverage as long as you can actually cover it and you're not going to be stopped out and you don't overgear yourself. So there are definitely things you can do, but they're going to require a lot more than buying an ETF and just remaining passive and opening the statement every month and seeing how much your passive ETFs have gone up, Eric. It's the same issue with the passive versus active allocations as it is growth versus value. I think this market, as well as swings in the actual general direction of indices, we are going to see swings whereby the active managers start to see inflows. We're going to start to see swings where value managers see inflows. And I think the age of the anonymous algorithmic custodian of your capital is, if not over, then it's certainly reaching the end of its short-term useful life. And I think you're going to start to need to know who is managing your money, what their strategy is, how they assess risk and how they, you know, mitigate risk. Because as I say, going back to what we spoke about a couple of minutes earlier, I think this year is going to be one of the riskiest years that we've seen in quite some time.
Let's talk about another trend that you and I have both discussed quite a bit over the last decade and hadn't been proven right on quite yet, which is we look at a company like Tesla and we just say, look, you can get excited about where you think Elon Musk maybe is headed technology-wise, but if you look at how many cars this company is realistically going to build and what the future cash flows are realistically going to be, the valuation just doesn't make sense. But you and I have talked about the temptation to short Tesla for years and years now. Is it finally time? Seems like even Elon Musk maybe has the idea, although he's claiming he has different reasons for selling some of his shares. Is it time for the crazy stocks like Tesla to finally roll over and break? Or is this just Elon taking a few bucks of profit off the table before it marches even higher, despite the fundamentals that you and I have never believed in?
Well, it's a great question. And I think Tesla has become one of the poster boys for this whole mindset, Eric. And yeah, the difficult part is, at no point in the last 10 years have any of the Tesla fundamentals justified its valuation. So what you're trying to figure out is, at what point does that matter to the people who are just rabid about the stock? And again, you know, anecdotally, here in the UK, I've been amazed these last couple of weeks. I've been driving around how many electric Audis I'm seeing and electric Jaguars I'm seeing. And there are electric cars everywhere on the roads. And you know, you notice them. There are Teslas here for sure. But it's interesting to see how many alternatives there are to Teslas now on the road in the UK, particularly, which is where I've been these last few weeks. And also, you know, hearing people talk about electric cars and, you know, I was thinking about getting a Tesla, but I went and test drove this new Audi e-tron. It's amazing, blah, blah, blah. You know, suddenly there are again catalysts in terms of the replacement cycle for Teslas is going to start ramping up now. You know, so these cars are getting older and people are going to want to chop them in for a new car. Now, 2 years ago, the only car they could have chopped it in for if they wanted another electric car, they wanted another fast electric car, was a Tesla. Well, now they've got options. And, you know, look, I'm speaking for myself. Some people, I'm sure, love the Spartan design of the Model S, for example. But when I look at that and I look at the interior of the Audi GT e-tron, it's not even close for me which car I'd rather own. And I don't care if the Tesla is 0.2 of a second faster 0-60. It just doesn't bother me. So I think 2022 again is going to be a tough year for Tesla, which is, you know, the pattern here is the stocks that have done well and had it pretty easy the last few years are going to start to struggle this year. Tesla, I suspect, is certainly one of them. You know, you talked about the temptation to short Tesla. You know, I haven't been short Tesla for some years now, not because I didn't think with every bone in my body that I wanted to short it, but because I realized that this became a narrative contest. And that's really one thing that Musk has done extraordinarily well is control the narrative. and sell the dream to people. And, you know, we could go through the litany of broken promises, but to some people that doesn't matter. So again, you know, can you justify the AMC price? Can you justify the GameStop price? Can you justify Tesla price? No, you can't. Not on any kind of fundamental. But the fact that it's trading on nothing to do with fundamentals means that if you are looking to short it, you've got to try and figure out the mindset of the crowd. And generally speaking, that is not something that's easy to do. Once it changes, once you see that mindset change, and once you see an increase in articles critical of Musk, which at the margin you've been seeing these last 4 or 5 months. I wrote a piece last month about the Theranos trial, and I think the Elizabeth Holmes verdict is going to be a seminal moment for a lot of these similar companies that make these lofty promises and have used this Silicon Valley idea of, you know, fake it till you make it. If Elizabeth Holmes is found guilty, then I think it changes an awful lot of things. It means that, you know, faking it till you make it is not okay. It's going to be called out as fraud, which, let's face it, is what it is. So if that happens, then, you know, Trevor Milton is the next cab off the rank, the founder of Nikola. He's up on trial sometime this year. And as you move up that ladder, the boss standing at the top of that ladder is Elon Musk, and they're moving up towards him. And so we'll see. Elizabeth Holmes may get found not guilty, in which case that may breathe more life into this idea that you can actually make up things as long as you sell a dream to people who are willing to invest in that dream. But again, I think we are seeing a shift, along with inflation coming back, we're seeing a shift change in all kinds of things. And one of those is the tolerance for people who promise but don't deliver. And if that is the case, if I'm right about that, then nobody promises more and delivers less than Elon Musk.
Let's talk about how energy is going to affect this whole inflation equation, because something I focus on a lot is, you know, I really can't tell you the timing, but I do know that if you stop investing in exploring for and finding new oil reserves, eventually that catches up with you and you don't have enough oil. And what we're doing is we're very aggressively phasing out fossil fuels, but we're not phasing in their replacement at the same speed. And, you know, if you look at the whole ESG trend and the way it's demonized investment in any kind of oil production assets, it sets up to me just an immutable future, which I know is coming. I just don't know how long it takes before it's realized, where we get to the point where we realize, oh shit, we really are going to move on to a green electrified economy, but we're not there yet. And we still need oil, and we stopped investing in finding it, and now we don't have enough, and we're screwed. And the price is through the roof, and it's driving inflation, making everything even worse. I think that that's a near certainty that that happens someday. I just don't know if it's this year or 3 years from now. What do you think of that? And if I'm right, what are the consequences and knock-on effects?
Well, it's interesting you say you don't know if it's right this year or in 3 years' time, and that's something that's worth talking about in the broader sense, is that people's time horizon, you know, think about it, the shift from 100 plus years of fossil fuels to green energy, and people are looking to invest in it and get it right in a year's time. You know, it's a much bigger shift than that. And while the world is definitely going to try and transition to cleaner energy, it could take 20 years, Eric, you know? And so you're right. I think you're absolutely right. This idea that we should stop investing in fossil fuel exploration is going to come back to bite us, the same way that shutting down all the world's nuclear power stations, or, you know, vast majority of them, in the wake of Fukushima has done similar. You know, the Germans are shutting off, I think, the rest of their nuclear power plants in the next week or two, at a time when the price they're paying for natural gas is through the roof, is causing some serious inflationary pressure, and they're having to beg, of all people, Vladimir Putin to send gas to them. You know, these decisions that get made in the kind of pursuit of being seen to be green, and I insert the word seen there deliberately, because a lot of this is all about what policies will end up getting us votes. Yes, look, we all agree that the minimum amount of damage we can do to the Earth is the preferable amount. But at the same time, we have lived in a society whose aim is to provide a more comfortable existence for more people every year. So how do you balance those two? How do you create a more comfortable existence for more people at the same time as being as careful a custodian as the earth of the earth as you can. And it's not simply flicking a switch. It's balancing the needs of the inhabitants of the earth with the ability to provide those and to lift people out of poverty in a means that does the least damage. Ultimately, it would be great to be solar, wind, and electric, hydroelectric energy dependent completely. Wouldn't that be wonderful for everybody except the oil companies? But it's not now. It's not going to happen in the next year. And by penalizing the oil companies before you've achieved that, ultimately, you're going to find yourself in the situation that Germany finds itself in now, in that Europe is finding itself now, in that Asia is finding itself in now, where they're having to pay crazy prices for natural gas as a cold winter comes through. And look, someone like Putin, who doesn't have to win re-election every 4 years, I mean, notionally he does, but that doesn't seem to be a problem for him, is in the position where he doesn't have to do these things. He can make decisions that aren't based on public opinion. And look, let's be honest, public opinion is terrible, right? I mean, it's swayed so easily, it shifts backwards and forwards. If you're trying to make policy based on public opinion, then I think it's a very dangerous thing to do. You know, this energy, or these energy markets have been in chaos for some time. In fact, I don't know if you follow Doomberg, but Doomberg, who has kind of appeared in the last 3, 4, 5, 6 months on Twitter, is a fantastic resource. They've written some really, really good stuff about not just natural gas, but the other assorted insanity going on in the energy markets. And just reading those pieces gives you a really good sense of some of the just crazy decisions they're getting made with the best of intention, but for all the wrong reasons. And that, to me, right now, in a time of great political division, is one of the biggest dangers, is that decisions are getting made based on the polls, the short-term polls, and you cannot conduct your energy policy based on short-term polls. It's a ludicrous thing to do, but it seems to be the way many countries in the West are choosing to do it, and that, I'm afraid, is going to end in chaos and tears, not necessarily in that order.
Well, let's talk about one final exciting, positive, energy, upbeat topic to round out this lovely interview, Grant, which is foreign affairs between U.S., Russia, and China. You know, I'm really getting concerned that the tensions in the world between the major nuclear-capable superpowers are getting more tense, not less tense. How do you see this, and what does it mean for financial markets?
Yeah, I think, Eric, that's going to be going to be one of the most important things to keep an eye on this year. I really do. I think we've known for the longest time that the Chinese have been angling for a higher chair at the table, and based on the size of the country and what they represent in the world, you could argue that they deserve that. Meanwhile, America's been fighting desperately to kind of maintain its hegemonic status, and again, completely understandable. And then in the background, you know, you have Russia and Vladimir Putin. And you know, Russia, again, I made the distinction between being a rich country and being a wealthy country. And Russia is the richest country in the world by far. The resources that Russia owns dwarf those of the other countries. They may not have the wealth, the material wealth that somewhere like America has, but they sit geographically right in the middle of the world. When they are aligned with China, and I just recorded a podcast with Simon Hunt talking about this, you know, this Halford Mackinder theory back from the early 1900s about the heartland. You know, he said that he who controls the heartland controls the world, and the heartland being essentially Eurasia. And, you know, we are seeing through a series of decisions made by the US, particularly around sanctions, they've been pushing the Russians and the Chinese closer and closer together over these last 10 years. You know, we're seeing pockets of the Middle East, major oil-producing countries like Iran, start to strike deals with both China and Russia. And what you have being built in plain sight is a block of countries with bilateral trade agreements right in the heartland, at the same time as we have America retrenching and really taking its troops home, withdrawing inwards and trying to lessen its footprint on the world stage. So everything is in place for some geopolitical upheaval. You know, you add into the fact that you have someone like Putin who is a master geopolitician, and he is now competing against the likes of Boris Johnson, of Joe Biden, of Justin Trudeau, of Scott Morrison, I mean, none of whom, I think it's fair to say, no matter what your political leanings, you could describe as a great leader in the true sense of the words. So, you know, we're looking at the situation in Ukraine now, and Putin is making demands on the West, and he's basically saying, look, I don't want the US or NATO to have their missiles on my doorstep. Now, that's being framed in Western media as Putin's belligerence. He, I'm sure, would point to the fact that it's essentially the same thing that the US said to Russia during the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, we don't want your missiles on our front doorstep, or we're prepared to go to war. Realistically, is there, in a world of hypersonic intercontinental ballistic missiles, is there a need for NATO to put missiles in the Ukraine right on Russia's doorstep? There probably isn't. I mean, they could certainly make that concession and say, oh, okay, fine, we'll leave one country buffer between you and us. But unfortunately, they've now got themselves into a geopolitical debate about this, and it's going to be very difficult to back down without looking weak. I suspect they'll need to try and find a way to back down and not look weak, because as we've seen, America particularly, given the situation in Afghanistan, is not looking to have so many foreign wars at the moment. I think Putin here realizes he has a pretty strong hand. There is plenty for Joe Biden to be concerned about at home. There are plenty of divisions inside the European Union and NATO that have them all fighting amongst themselves. And he's just starting to put a little bit of political pressure on them with the Ukraine situation. He's starting to put a little bit of financial pressure on them with the gas. And he's in a great position. Now, he could very well overstep the mark and miscalculate this and make mistakes in how he handles it. And we could absolutely end up accidentally in a conflict. But right now, is he going to gamble that, you know what, if I do go into Ukraine, are they going to stop me? You know, he probably is. It's a gamble he might want to take. I mean, he got away with Crimea, and certainly the West is far more fractured now than it was when that happened. I don't think it'll happen imminently. I read an interesting piece by Neil Ferguson about it, and talking about how Putin sees himself as Peter the Great and how him invading Ukraine is inevitable. I don't necessarily think that's the case. I think he would be much happier if he could get NATO to back down and even commit to talks that postpone the placement of missiles in Ukraine and de-escalates that situation of trying to get Ukraine to join NATO. But there is a real chance of a miscalculation here amongst a group of leaders. On the one hand, with Putin, who needs to look strong, Xi is in the same position. There is all kinds of anecdotal evidence to suggest that there is an agreement between the two of them that should either of them be attacked, the other one will come to their aid. That could be problematic. So, you know, if you look at the situation that Joe Biden's facing, I look at the situation Boris Johnson's facing here in the UK, and it's pretty clear if you look at what's happening with any degree of interest that Boris is being set up to be pushed out by the Tory party. And I would suspect Liz Truss, based on all the interviews I'm seeing and the headlines and the very grand pictures of her I'm seeing staged in newspapers like The Telegraph and The Times, that she will soon be the leader in waiting. There are any number of ways in which a miscalculation could be made here. I just happen to think that right now, the West does not really have anybody who can compete with Putin when it comes to playing geopolitics. And that, I suspect, might give him the upper hand that he needs to kind of push through some really serious moves here, which, look, I mean, in the fullness of time, if the West backs down over Ukraine, would that be looked upon badly? I doubt it. If in the fullness of time they don't back down and Russia invades Ukraine, that might end up looking like a very, very poor decision by the West. So I think Putin has a really good hand here. And I suspect if anyone's going to play it well, it's going to be him. So I'm watching that situation very, very closely, because I think we'll be able to tell a lot about what's going to happen between the US, China, and Russia by how the West handles Putin's demands.
Well, Grant, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, I want to cover one final topic, which is a transition that we've seen in financial journalism. You were involved in the launch of a television network a few years ago. You've actually moved on now to where you're really focusing on not so much having a big audience, but having a high-quality audience. Tell us a little bit more about what's going on at grant-williams.com. It's not just the things that make you go, newsletter, which you're very well known for, but your new podcast, I got to admit, is just as good as Macro Voices, and I don't say that about anybody else. So what's going on there? Tell us a little more about your motives and who your listeners are and how people who are interested can follow your work.
High praise indeed, Eric. Thank you. Yeah, look, I've been putting written content out for a decade now. This will be the 10th year of me doing it. It's been a fantastic exercise for me in terms of trying to get my own thinking straight. And if I can write my thoughts in a way that other people understand, then it helps me understand that I've kind of framed the debate correctly. I added the podcast last year during lockdown. It was a means to kind of stay in touch with the world and get the opinions of a group of people. And that's become popular, which I'm delighted about. And I've had some phenomenal guests on there. And also my co-hosts and some of my other podcasts that are part of the kind of platform, Bill Fleckenstein, Steph Pomboy, and Ben Hunt, have been huge additions to that in terms of broadening the conversation. And then about 5 months ago, I launched a video tier, which it's nothing fancy. It's one video a month, but for me, these are important conversations. They're big picture conversations, not necessarily about what the market's going to do in the next week or month or 3 months, but really, it's an attempt to get into people's brains, experienced practitioners, whether they be investors or economists, or I just finished published an interview with Don Yeager, who was an associate editor of Sports Illustrated for many, many years and a best-selling author. And just digging into people's brains to talk about their experiences, I find yields information that is valuable far longer than anything when you're talking about markets. That stuff has an enormous immediate value, but there's not really much point in listening to market-based predictions a few months hence, whereas if you actually dig into someone's life and experiences and kind of pull out the lessons they've learned from what's happened to them along the way, good and bad, that kind of conversation stands up to repeated viewing over many, many years. There are lessons you can learn every time you listen to that. So, I know that's not the kind of thing that is huge in terms of audience size, but I'm not doing it to try and build myself a massive audience. I'm trying to do it to fulfill what I think is a need that some people have, to try and get better at what they do rather than figure out what's going on. And, it's something that I've been overwhelmed by the response to it, which has been great. And it's something that I'm looking forward to through this year, expanding and broadening out and having some conversations, which I think will over time prove immensely valuable. There's a growing community there. We all communicate via a dedicated Slack channel, and I've learned far more than I've taught from that community over the last 5 months. It's been remarkable, the kind of resources available and the expertise that people have in different areas that you can tap into. And so I think community is going to be very important in 2022, and it doesn't have to be an enormous community for the sake of having a big community. It needs to be a community that have shared values and shared desires in terms of the outcomes they want, and a willingness to exchange ideas. And I think by building something like that, you create something that's tremendously powerful and has great sustainability. So I'm really excited about it. I've loved doing all of it so far, and I'm really looking forward to 2022, Eric.
And I definitely want to add my own personal endorsement, Grant. I really enjoy listening to your interviews. It's what I do in the treadmill, and I strongly encourage our listeners to check it out. You can do that at grant-williams.com. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. I've talked with several guests about topics like inflation and fears of a market correction. And those are real concerns for many investors. I'm sure many of you are wondering where to put your money. Many investors are turning to alternative assets for protection. You could look into traditional assets like gold, real estate, and bonds, but there's one unexpected asset everyone's talking about lately: blue chip art. Its growth has outpaced the S&P 500 from 1995 through 2020. And it has almost no correlation to other asset classes. In other words, its value doesn't drop as much as other investments when markets crash. Most people don't realize you can now invest in million-dollar art by Banksy, Monet, and even Picasso. To discover how to access this asset class, visit masterworks.art/macrovoices. That's masterworks.art/macrovoices. See important disclosures at macrovoices.io/disclaimer.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Eric, it was a great idea to bring Grant back on the show for the start of the year. His insights were really interesting. What did you take away from the interview?
You know, it is always such a pleasure to work with Grant Williams. Just a little bit of backstory to share with our listeners. We taped this interview originally well before Christmas, plenty of time ahead of time, make it easy on everybody, holiday schedules, etc. Grant ended up emailing us and saying, listen, guys, you know, things have changed, markets changed. We had a couple of technical difficulties in that recording session that distracted us. We can do better. And so we re-recorded it this week at Grant's request, just because he's that committed to really doing everything that he does as well as he can. I really, really admire his professionalism and dedication to the exceptionalism that he does in all of his work. And I can't recommend his podcast highly enough. I listen to it myself on the treadmill when I'm at the gym. In any event, Patrick, let's move on to our own post-game chart book. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to the website, macrovoices.com, click the red button on the homepage that says looking for the downloads. Page 2, S&P 500 continuous futures chart. What do we got going on here?
Well, Erica, I want to really put in context the three major indices, the S&P, NASDAQ, and the Russell, in terms of how they have relatively performed. What was interesting is that we did have a really strong year-end surge to a fresh new 52-week high on the S&P 500. And it really does look actually quite bullish just from the charts. Even with this recent pullback on the reactions to FOMC, it's been just about a 50% retracement of the prior rise. Still, the previous highs can act as support, can still hold above its moving averages. And it's hard to make an argument that just on the chart on the surface looks bearish. But when we go to page 3 and look at the NASDAQ, it's interesting to start seeing where some of these divergences or different price actions occurring. During this whole sequence, the NASDAQ failed to actually make a higher high when the S&P did. And more importantly, it was very quick to give back the entire gain and come right back to the bottom of its trade range that it's been in through November and December. And what we continue to see is now a larger amount of these FANG stocks are starting to actually break down and deteriorate in price. There are a few that are still holding up, but generally these are like the big market cap behemoths that are driving these indices. And the bigger question is, if we see that they continue to underperform and show some sort of distribution or basically simply a lack of participation, can the S&P 500 run higher? And so it's an interesting way to kind of put in context. And I think if we look under the surface, I think it's going to be really important to see whether or not the breadth can widen enough to compensate or whether the FANG stocks will dominate this trend. But on page 4, where I have the Russell 2000, the small cap index, it looks even more ominous, because while we had a very bullish breakout in October into November, early November, that Russell gave back the entire gain. And during this period where the NASDAQ and S&P went to press to new highs or attempt to, the Russell was barely able to make any meaningful bounce off of its lows. It really shows that this continues to be driven by only the largest cap stocks that are driving these indices, and the breadth is still relatively poor. Now, an interesting thing that will be something to watch is, based upon your narrative that you spoke about in the market wrap, I think that if, in fact, the Omicron does end up actually kind of crowding out the COVID fears and things reopen, would we have a rotation where things like those mega cap stocks sell, but the small caps suddenly start to get money flow as the real economy is starting to come back into action? There's certainly no technical sign of that, but it's certainly going to be interesting to see whether or not that is something that emerges throughout the year.
On page 5, you've got the dollar-yen cross. What's up there?
Well, it's interesting because this is the one part where the U.S. dollar is potentially showing signs of further bullishness. While the euro, which is the large market cap weighting in the dollar index, continues to pin the dollar index, what's interesting is that that U.S. dollar legitimately broke out against the Japanese yen and looks like we might be even heading toward 117 or higher on this move. And it'll be really interesting to see when you kind of break down so many of the major currency crosses, the U.S. dollar looks like it's in pretty good shape right across the board against each pairing. While we're in that trade range, it really does feel like the dollar has a shot for further upside strength. Moving on, though, Eric, to page six, here's that chart of crude oil. And you were just talking about that in the market wrap. And I just thought we'd just put some visual to this. What's interesting is that the real breakout to me was when we were able to beat that $73 level. That was where there were some key hurdles. And it's been nothing but upside since then. The one thing that I'll be watching, though, here on crude is that often as you go and test a previous high, at minimum, it tends to stall the price action. And so as we, even though I'm very bullish about this trend, we are slowly approaching within dollars of testing a key overhead resistance. It'll be interesting to see whether that spurs some selling. And more importantly, if the pattern of buying dips continues when we do inevitably get some of that like pause and mean reversion occurring. One way or another, it is a bullish chart, just some short-term resistance coming up.
Patrick, I agree with all of your analysis. I was fortunate enough to be able to use Monday's revisit of the 100-day continuation moving average to get back into half of my position at only a little bit above where I got out of it, thinking that the Omicron panic might scare the market lower, which turned out not to happen. And I'm going to be looking at any more dips to get into what remains of the position that I need to scale back into, having missed some significant upside here. So I do think there's probably another dip coming, but I also think that we're headed towards $100 here and substantially higher than that if we don't see some significant investment in energy, which I don't see happening. So I think prices are headed much higher longer term, but for now, we're maybe a little bit overdone on the upside. Let's move on, though, to page seven, where we've got gold futures. Boy, it looks like we're kind of reversing to the downside, getting a little bit ugly here.
Right. And I mean, I think that right now, when we go to the further pages, we'll see that interest rates are rising, which typically does have some drag. Usually it's the real rates that are being influenced the most on it. But certainly this FOMC reaction took all the wind out of the sails of gold. I continue to think that 1800 round number where all those moving averages are is truly the arbiter of the new trend. If we see, like you were suggesting, any sustained price action that is failing to get back above 1800 and just consolidating there, then while I'm not necessarily bearish gold, there isn't much stopping gold from trading to the bottom end of its trade ranges and revisiting 1750 on the downside while it gets stuck in the mud waiting for the window for where it can meaningfully rally. One way or another, it'll be important to watch this week. This is the first break back down below 1800. Let's see if it sticks.
Well, I agree, Patrick, and I think it's important to acknowledge here that, you know, the prognosis for gold, the reason that a lot of people were bullish gold is we thought that negative interest rates were coming and that there would be debasement of fiat currency. Well, it's all happening. We've got deeply negative real interest rates, and that was the big thing everybody thought was going to ignite gold to the upside. And what we've seen is that other inflation trades like copper and oil have performed much, much better. So I think it's time to acknowledge here that gold's not doing what most people expected it to do. Maybe it's just taking its time and not quite there yet, but boy, it sure is taking its time. In any event, let's move on to lumber futures. Boy, they're recovering pretty substantially. A lot of people said that the big run-up in lumber futures was all about supply chains and, you know, it was a one-time thing. It's all going to be over. We're never going to see it again. Well, look what's happening again.
Unbelievable. Like, well, obviously, we had this parabolic blow off back in the second quarter of 2021 as lumber hit 1700 plus on the upside. And then we had an extraordinarily deep bear market correction that basically wiped out the entire advance in its entirety, going right back down to 2020 lows near 500. Usually, when you see that type of a reversal, the price of something in a bear market would stay and consolidate along its lows for extended periods of time. And it's I find it actually quite surprising how quickly lumber has turned right back up and seems to be starting a brand new parabolic move, like a deja vu of what happened last year. It'll be really interesting to see whether the bulls continue to gain momentum and whether we start seeing limit up days again in the lumber markets. But boy, has this been one of the stronger trends that's been in the commodity space.
And to think that the lumber market bottomed in August, right in the middle of home building season. Not exactly what I would have expected. Let's move on to pages 9, 10, and 11, Patrick, where we're taking a look at yields on treasuries, on investment grade, and on junk.
That's right. You know, the interesting part about this move on the 10-year treasury yields was that while certainly the trend continued in the post-FOMC meeting minutes, what's interesting is the move started well before those days before. And we're really seeing suddenly treasury bond markets starting to legitimately break down. And I wonder whether or not it may be tied to the move in the U.S. dollar against the yen as well, as it could be flows that are influenced from there. But one way or another, these 10-year treasury yields are trying to break out to above those 2021 highs. But what's interesting is that this is no longer just treasury yields. We're starting to see legitimate weakness developing in corporates as well. I have, like you were saying, on page 10, the investment grade corporate bond ETF LQD. And what's interesting is that there's been very distinct weakness in corporate bonds all last year. And here we have a breakdown below the fourth quarter lows. And it really looks almost like the bond breakdown in corporates is just accelerating. Even when we look at the junk bond market, which usually has shorter duration on page 11, a very distinct rollover failure to even legitimately retest its previous highs and really makes it vulnerable for further weakness. And what's interesting is sometimes we've seen bond market moves lead stock market moves. And I think that with the fact that we're seeing these breakdowns, I wonder whether or not this is a canary in the coal mine to some potential equity weakness going into February. Sometimes there's a lag in this, but if we continue to see weakness in this market, it'll certainly be one of the things to watch whether that translates to selling in broader equities.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, be sure to check out bigpicturetrading.com, where a free trial will get you a Patrick Ceresna chart deck every single day of the week. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Masterworks, the billion-dollar alternative investment platform that lets you invest in art by legends like Warhol and Picasso for a fraction of the cost. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to this chart book that we just discussed in the postgame. There's also a link to a Convexity Maven article titled A Model Portfolio for 2022. There's also a Bill Blaine article on Omens and Signs, What Lies Ahead. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, at Macro Voices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. That's Eric spelt with a K, and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.